Matthew 7, 13 through 29. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many, for the gate is narrow, and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, you will recognize them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house upon the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears those words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house in the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. When Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. This is the word of the Lord.
We began studying the Sermon on the Mount 10 weeks ago. Today we come to the end of the sermon. 10 weeks ago we started our study by asking three kingdom questions. Where is the kingdom? When will the kingdom come? What are the kingdom values? We learn in the very first verses of the sermon that where is the kingdom? It's both here and there. When will the kingdom come? It comes now and then. That's what these Kingdom at Hand videos have been all about. People that are experiencing the their kingdom here. People that are experiencing the then kingdom now, whether it's in a small group or whether it's in their art studio. We then ask the question, what are the kingdom values? And we learned that in order to understand the kingdom values, we would need to learn how to think the opposite. So we leaned in closely to Jesus and listened to his words on kingdom impact, the impossible kingdom, kingdom integrity, kingdom relationships, kingdom discipline, kingdom ambition, kingdom peace, kingdom attitude. And today, we'll talk about kingdom commitment. And typically in my sermons, I like to give you a little preview, a sort of a synopsis, maybe in one sentence of what Jesus might be saying about kingdom commitment. But I have to wait. I can't give it to you right now at the beginning of the sermon, even though I want to. I'll tell you why, because that's not how Jesus actually delivers his sermon. It's not how Jesus seeks the response from his initial hearers or how we'll seek his response from us today. Let me explain by telling you a little bit about how I got engaged. Now, just a quick preview here. My wife does not like it when I tell this story. Nina says, don't tell that story. I end up looking best. And Nina, no, you don't look bad. I look bad. I'm the one that should look bad in this story. You're the hero of the story. You decided in, you know, a matter of seconds how you were going to spend the rest of your life. You look great in the story. It's me that messed everything up because Nina and I started dating in February of our senior year of college. We had known each other for a long time. We actually were in the same kindergarten class. So when my kids go off to kindergarten, I'm always going, man, what are these guys like, sizing them up in the kindergarten class? You just never know. So we were in the same kindergarten class. We knew each other growing up. We never dated, but we did. We were friends, and so it seemed like it was moving along pretty quickly, and we made this pact that said, we won't talk about the future until at least April. We gave ourselves at least that long, even though we knew the future was coming quickly with graduation and life plans would have to be made. And I was the speaker for a retreat for some high school students, and I had like a weekend in the woods, and I go, just April, you know, what is gonna happen? Nina had applied to some things, and she said, let's wait until I hear back from some of those things to see what life is shaping up to be before we even start talking about the future. And I remember talking to the pastor of the students at this retreat, and he said, you know, do you want to marry this girl or not? I said, yes, I want to marry this girl. He said, so what does it matter what she hears in April? I said, you're right. I'm going to preemptively ask her to marry me before April 1st. Again, we just started dating at the beginning of February. And so I tell Nina, I said, hey, let's go visit my grandmother. And I wanted her to meet my grandmother who lived just outside of New York City. And we met my grandma and we had lunch and we set off on a journey into New York City and saw a Broadway show. And after the show, Nina doesn't know, but I've got the ring in my pocket and I am going to preemptively, prior to April 1st, ask her to marry me. And so we go on a walk in a park. And what she doesn't know is that two of my roommates have driven to New York. They've set up a table with some dessert in this park. And so we're going through a walk in the park, and all of a sudden there's this table. I'm like, oh, look at this table with this dessert. Let's sit down. I think this is for us. And she looks at me and says, you're not going to propose, are you? I stayed strong. I did not let that deter me on any level. Now, what happened, what was interesting at this time, though, one of my other roommates asked me, he said, hey, you know, she said don't do anything till April 1st. You know, what are the odds that she's going to say yes? Like, what kind of odds do you think you're working with? And I said, I don't know, maybe 65-35. He says, so you're telling me there's a 35% chance you're coming back from New York with that ring still in your pocket? I said, I think so. Is that not good? So she says, you're not going to propose, are you? I say, no, of course not. Why would I do a silly thing like that? And we sit down and we're having the dessert, and she just won't relax. She keeps asking all these questions. Who put this here? Where did this dessert come from? How'd you get a table in New York City? She just keeps asking all of these different questions. She's like, what are we doing? I finally go, you want to know what we're doing here? Here's what we're doing here. And I get out, I get on my knee, and I say, that's what we're doing here. And she looks at me as I get down on my knee and says, no, stop, get up. What are you doing? The odds makers in Vegas are shifting right about now. I push through. I go through with the speech, and I say, you know, will you marry me? And she kind of looks at me and goes, yeah. I said, I'm gonna ask you again. And I did the whole speech over again. And once I finished the speech, there's this silence. And I am just dying on the inside, just the seconds, excruciating second after excruciating second is passing. And finally she says, yes, I will marry you. And Nina is the hero of this story because she decided later on, I asked her, I said, what was going on? I said, what was going on in your mind? You know, as I sat there in silence, she said, I was literally deciding what I was gonna do with the rest of my life. And that's why I say Nina is the hero of the story, because she decided to make a commitment that would change the entire trajectory of her life in a mere 10 seconds. They were excruciating for me, but I think she is the hero of that story. Those 10 seconds as they clicked off, each one more painful as the next, because I wanted an immediate response. Whenever we want something in life, whenever we're going after something, whenever we order something, we want it to come immediately. We want to have it now, especially when it's something as important as asking someone to marry you. You see, as Jesus ends the Sermon on the Mount, he actually approaches it in a much different way. He's not looking for an immediate response. He's looking for a deliberate response, a considered response, an informed response. As we come to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, unlike me who pushed for an immediate response, Jesus does not push his listeners to respond. Instead, he prepares them to respond. It's a big difference. And this is why I want to take some time to show you what Jesus did in preparation for our response, in preparation for our consideration of commitment to him and to his kingdom. You see, the content of the sermon actually ends in verse 12 with the golden rule. So whatever you wish to do, whatever you wish others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. That's in Matthew 7, 12. And the response that the people give is actually in Matthew chapter 7, verse 28. And so everything in between there, all the way from Matthew 7, 13 to Matthew 7, 27, all of that is Jesus taking some time, not demanding an immediate response, but preparing us to respond deliberately to him. And here's what he does. Here's how he prepares us to respond. He tells us four stories that each have two outcomes to lead us to one response. Four stories he's going to tell between, after verse 12, before the response, four stories he'll tell. Each of the four stories all have two possible outcomes leading up to one response. And I will just let you know that one response, it's your response. It's my response. And so let me tell you the first story. The first story might be called Two Gates. It's in verses 13 to 14. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life. And those who find it are few. You're going to see all of these, this imagery of two in this passage all throughout to help us understand the two possible outcomes. Notice the twos in this story. Two gates, two ways, easy, hard. Not that, we're not there yet, Cliff. Easy, hard, many, few, narrow, wide. All of these contrasts that Jesus is attempting to get you to see in the story is he's leading you to the ultimate contrast, which are the two possible outcomes for this story and all of the rest of the stories. And the two possible outcomes, if you look at the passage, he says there's one way that leads to destruction and there's another way that leads to life. And those are the two outcomes, destruction versus life, destruction versus life. See, in the first story, there are two gates. They represent two outcomes, and they prepare you for your one response. The second story might be called Two Trees. Let me read it to you, verses 15 through 20. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, you will recognize them by their fruits. It's interesting in this story that Jesus talks about how you might distinguish between false prophets and true prophets. Because if you were one of the first listeners, or even us here in the 21st century, and you hear all of these radical claims Jesus is making, radical claims about the Bible as they knew it in the first century. They called it the Torah, the law. They called it the prophets, and that was the rest of the Old Testament as we have it. Jesus is making all of these radical claims about the law, about the prophets, about the Bible. You might go, wow, these are interesting claims. How do I know if this guy's a true prophet or not? How do I know if he's the real deal, if I can actually trust him? And unlike so many people today, when you question their authority or question their motives, Jesus does not say, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Jesus says, let me give you a simple test so you can know for sure if I am a true prophet or not. The simple test is this. There's not a good tree that bears bad fruit, and there's not a diseased tree that bears good fruit. So why don't you inspect the fruit of my life and ministry, and you can decide right there for yourself. This is actually what Jesus does a little later in the gospel when John the Baptist has some questions about Jesus's identity. It'll come up in Matthew chapter 11, verses 2-5, but John the Baptist is in prison. He's hearing lots of rumors about who Jesus might be and what his ministry is all about. And he goes, I can't take it anymore. Who are you? And this is what we read in Matthew chapter 11, verse 2. Now, when John heard in prison about the deeds of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Jesus answered them, go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised, and the poor have good news preached to them. In other words, John, inspect the fruit. What do you see here? There's a simple test whether you know if there's a true prophet or a false prophet. Is the tree bearing good fruit, or is the tree bearing bad fruit? And while the story of the two trees is used initially here to distinguish between false prophets and true prophets, the same picture is used by Jesus in Matthew chapter 12, verse 33, to describe everyone. He says everyone's life, not just prophets, but everyone's life will be like one of two trees. Everyone's life will either bear good fruit or bear bad fruit. And so he says we must examine our lives. And what's interesting about this story that Jesus tells is you don't blame the fruit. If the fruit isn't good, you say, well, what kind of tree are you connected to? And so as we examine the fruit in our lives, that would be the question I would ask all of us. What tree are we connected to? From where are we deriving the source of our life? This is an important concept that Jesus repeats twice in this very short story. In verse 16, he starts the story saying, you will recognize them by their fruits. And in verse 20, he ends the story saying, thus you will recognize them by their fruits. There are two possible outcomes in the story of the two trees. One of the outcomes is bear good fruit. You can bear good fruit, or the other outcome is to be thrown into the fire. That's what happens to the diseased trees that are not bearing good fruit. You see, in the second story, there are two trees representing two outcomes to prepare you for your one response. The third story you might call two declarations. It's in verses 21 through 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. This is a difficult passage to understand. People often read this passage and I mean, you can start to shake a little bit looking at these people who are calling Jesus the right thing, Lord, Lord, who seem to be doing the right things by working in his name. They even says that not just that they did some works, they did many works Not that they did just many decent works, they did many mighty works. So we step back and go, what is this passage really talking about? What are these two declarations all about? And the two declarations of the passage are the people crying out, Lord, Lord, and Jesus' declaration, I never knew you. Those are the two different declarations that Jesus is dealing with here in this passage. Well, one of my chief strategies for understanding the Bible, anyone can do. It doesn't take any kind of advanced education or any extra book or any commentary or a Bible dictionary. I just often advise people, read the passage slowly. Read it a little bit more slowly. What is Jesus saying here? Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. This is the key to understanding the story. The real contrast, the real difference between the two declarations is my will versus thy will. The people kept working for Jesus, but they never stopped and paused long enough to question their motives, to say, am I doing what he's asked me to do, or am I doing what will make me look good? Am I working on his behalf in the way he's asking me to do it, or am I working on his behalf in the way I'd like to do it? Did I ever substitute my agenda for his agenda? That's the real contrast in the story. My will versus thy will. We must get to the point with our declaration of Jesus. What we call him must be correct. How we work for him must be correct. But all of that goes away if we never pause and say, God, what is your will? And I will submit to thy will before I ever push my will. There are two outcomes in this story. The first outcome is enter the kingdom, and the second outcome is depart from me. When we constantly say, my will be done, eventually Jesus says, yes, your will be done. You never really wanted to be with me, did you? Depart from me. But when we exchange my will for thy will, Jesus says to us, enter the kingdom. And let me just tell you, you've been in the kingdom the whole time. Remember, the kingdom is here and there. It's now and then. When we do thy will, when we put his will before our will, we're experiencing the kingdom now. And so Jesus says, enter the kingdom. The third story has two declarations representing two outcomes to prepare you for your one response. The fourth story might be called Two Builders. Two Builders. Let me read you the story of the two builders. It's in verses 24 through 27. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against that house and it fell. And great was the fall of it. In this last story, you see some similarities between it and the first story in that there are many contrasts. Remember the first story of the two gates. There were many, there were few, there was wide, there was narrow. There are a lot of contrasts in this story. Wise, foolish, rock, sand, doing, not doing, fall, not fall. But in addition to all these different contrasts in the story, there's actually one constant. There's one thing that remains the same for both the wise builder and the foolish builder. Let me read it to you. There's the wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. And there's a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Did you catch the constant? The rains always come. The floods always rise. The wind does not relent. Jesus is clear that our best intentions in life will be challenged. Our most thought through plans in life will be tested. And whatever foundation on which we build our lives, Jesus assures us, it will be shaken. Time and tempest will reveal the wisdom or the foolishness of our life's choices. The distinction that Jesus makes here between wise and foolish is directly connected to one thing: putting Jesus' words into practice or not putting Jesus' words into practice. If we're willing to hear this sermon and say, yes, Jesus, I will not just listen to what you say, I will do what you say, we become like the wise person in the story. If we listen to this sermon, and I love this because everyone listening to the sermon now has to make this choice. We've all heard the sermon. The people originally, it only takes about 20, 25 minutes to read. We've been looking at it for 11 weeks now. We've all heard the sermon, and we could decide we've heard the sermon, but I'm going to go back to my life as I like to live it and not put any of this into practice. Then you will be like the foolish person in the story. And there are two outcomes, just like all of the other stories. The two outcomes in this story: one house did not fall, and the other house, great was the fall. You see, in the fourth story, there are two builders representing two outcomes to prepare you for your one response. Remember, Jesus doesn't demand an immediate response. He's not like me counting the seconds that are going by before you say, okay, Jesus, here's what I think about your sermon. It's only after these four stories about gates, trees, declarations, and builders, and their corresponding two outcomes that represent life in the kingdom or life apart from the kingdom, it's only after all that the crowd is sufficiently prepared to offer their one response. Are you interested in what that response might be? You can find it in Matthew chapter 7, verses 28 and 29. And when Jesus finished saying these things, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. Their response is two things. It's astonishment. They step back and just go, wow, we've never heard anything like this. And it is obvious that this person who is speaking has some kind of authority that we're unfamiliar with. And we need to evaluate under what authority are we currently living. And maybe we need to shift our allegiance and put our lives under the authority of Jesus. This word astonished is an interesting word in the Greek. It's hard to translate, but you might actually say it means shock. They're just shocked. They're just, wow, step back, astonished. And I put a transliteration of the Greek word up here, not because I expect us to know that that means shock, but you can see there's an important English word that comes from it, ekplelesomai. It's where we get our word epileptic from. It's just, whoa, sort of a jolt, a shock to the system, everything that Jesus said. They're astounded, and they evaluate the level of authority with which he is speaking, and they're considering putting their lives under that authority. Do you join the crowd there that first time this sermon was preached? Are you shocked? Are you astounded? Are you just amazed? Are you submitted to Jesus' authority? Or are you still living under your own authority? I think a good way to summarize the response for us, the question that we need to answer after having been prepared with four stories with two outcomes for the one response, is this question: am I committed to my kingdom or Jesus' kingdom? Am I committed to my kingdom or to Jesus' kingdom? And I would submit to all of us this day that if you want to be committed to Jesus' kingdom, the move that must be made is to surrender to the King. That's what needs to happen. Am I committed to my kingdom or Jesus' kingdom? And if you want to submit to Jesus' kingdom, consider this morning, surrendering to the King. This past summer, I got into something interesting. You're probably not gonna hear many people say, I got interested in this, but it really caught me by surprise and I got pretty deep into it. I got into epic poetry this summer. I had a lot of time on my hands. You sent me on sabbatical. So I got into epic poetry this summer and I started reading some of the great classic epic poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey. And I started looking at what people said about these poems and how epic poetry works and why it survived for thousands of years for us to even be reading today. And what I learned as I considered these epic poems and read about them was that epic poems always begin with the core theme of the entire poem in the first line of the poem. Whatever the poem is about, the author embeds that theme right there in the first line. So you're not reading for five chapters going, what's going on? You get it right there in the first line. And in Homer's poem, The Iliad, the first line is rage. The rage of Achilles, a man of great anger and frustration, and you are gonna hear about it. When he begins the Odyssey, the word is Odysseus, a man of wandering, and you just watch this guy wander to and fro across the earth. And again, these epic poems were really culture-shaping poems. They really framed the worldview of entire civilizations. And so the Greeks had these images of rage and of wandering. But along came the Romans who conquered the Greeks, and they were not to be outdone. They said, we need to have our own epic poem. And so just before the first century, a man named Virgil penned a poem called the Aeneid. And he said, here's what Roman society is all about. Arms. That's how it starts. Pick up arms and fight and battle, and we will dominate the world. Eventually, after the Greek culture had their rage and their wandering, and the Roman culture had their arms, a Christian man decided to write an epic poem to help people understand the Christian worldview. It was in the 1300s. His name was Dante. The first Christian epic poem in response to these pagan poems. The first line of the Divine Comedy, I awoke in the middle of my life to find that I was wholly lost in a dark wood. Lost. That's how it starts. Lost. To surrender to the King means to admit that we are lost. It's how Jesus started the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the people that know that they don't know everything. Blessed are the people that can say, I am lost and I need help finding my way. Maybe this morning you just want to say, I'm done with my rage. I'm tired of my rage. I'm done taking up arms and fighting. I'm tired of taking up arms and fighting. I'm done wandering. I'm so tired of wandering. And just say, I surrender my life now. I am poor in spirit. I am lost. I want to invite the band to come and help us as we consider our surrender to the King. Because if we want to commit to Jesus' kingdom, we must surrender to the King, who not only said, enter by the gate, but claimed to be the gate. Jesus said, I am the gate. Who not only spoke of trees and fruit, but who said, I am the true vine. Apart from me, you'll bear no fruit. Who didn't just speak of houses that were built on rocks, but he spoke of a confession of his identity as Christ, which means King, as the rock upon which the church and all those who follow him, that confession of him as King, as the rock upon which all of their lives stood or fell. You see, Jesus prepares his listeners to respond. He prepares them with four stories that all have two outcomes so that they might have one response. To surrender to the King. Will you surrender to him right now? All you have to say in your heart, I surrender my life now. Let's ponder that as the band plays and we'll be invited to join with them.